Excuse me. Hey, boys. Yeah, you. Yeah. Got something to say? Share it with the whole class.
All right. Welcome to the Back of the Class, a guide to education from the kids at the back of the class. Thanks to those of you who are joining us and who have decided to follow us. We can be found on iTunes by searching for Back of the Class, and we can be reached via email at thebackoftheclass@yahoo.com. We also have a blog that my fine co-host Daniel has actually posted on, and that's thebackoftheclass.blogspot.com. Love to hear from you. Give us your thoughts. It would be great to see what you guys are thinking. So this is the show where the kids at the back of the class, Danny and I, we talk about a topic. I'm going to introduce Danny this time, and he can do his best to introduce me. You notice how I took the first one because we're going to use the same thing? No, I'll come up with Danny. Danny, I don't know what your title is, but it's something to do with director of technology, or is that what it is for the chief technical?
You know, have at it. I've been called far worse than technical.
Can I just call you chief?
Yeah, that would be a good start for tonight.
All right. Joining me is the chief.
I like that a lot.
Actually, since I'm a Raiders fan, I can't call you a chief. I can't do it.
You can do it.
No.
I believe in you.
You believe in me all you want, but I've got a bad taste in my mouth for the Chiefs. But anyway, the chief technical director for technology at Chapel Hill Carborough School District, Daniel Curry Corcoran, joining me tonight, and I'll just call you Chief. That's fine, Chief. And you have
Chief or Doctor Chief.
No, Doctor Chief's too highfalutin.
It is a little highfalutin, I guess.
Yeah, no, I'll just stick with Chief. It's because you can chief stuff. You can use it as an honorarium or an honorific, or you can use it as a verb.
Like, I think you just verbed it. Yeah, you verbed it.
You're chiefing stuff out. Anyway, there you go. That's my introduction to you, Danny. Go. You can introduce me now.
Well, it's a pleasure, man. I think this is my first time ever introducing you on the podcast. So, I had a very brief. But I would just like, to give it a whirl. Patrick O'Shea is associate professor of instructional technology at Appalachian State University. It is my pleasure to introduce Pat. He's been a longtime friend and colleague from the days when we were intern teachers in Norfolk Public Schools, all the way through studying different technological advancements in college settings. And he's also one of my dearest mutter brothers. Always there to get me in over an obstacle when we're not following his flowing locks around the course. Those may not know, those of you who are new to our mud racing part of the podcast, is that, we're usually following Patrick. He is he's known as the gazelle. He's out front on the course. So we like to watch his flowing locks. That's how we track him down.
Did you see the blog post I put up on our Year in the Mud blog?
A new one? No, I don't know. You had a new one.
Yeah, I put a new one up, and it has that gif of the guy who's running through electroshock therapy and gets clotheslined by the stuff and gets pulled back. You know that gif?
Yes.
Yeah, I put it on there because I was talking about the new obstacles. We could talk. Let's save this and we'll talk about it at the end. How about that?
Good.
Well, thank you. That was very kind of you, Daniel. I feel bad for my flip introduction now.
That's all right.
Yeah.
Well. You came up with the title The Chief as the best introduction yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess. As those of you who joined us last week will know, we've changed the format of this show a little bit. We used to be a threesome, but now we're just a duo. Simon is off in the woods somewhere. He'll find his way back at some point.
I miss him. It's his compassionate soul that made the whole program.
That's right. Plus, we got to make fun of him. So,
well.
Which is more fun when he's here.
It's fun when he's not too, but definitely more fun when he's here.
That's true. So we've changed it, and so we're going to talk about a specific topic for about 20 minutes or so, and we're going to look at it from the context of through the lens, I should say, of K-12 education, since Danny, you're in K-12, and through university education, since I'm at the university level. Do you want to give us an intro to what our topic is for tonight?
Let me see if I can actually pull it up. Did I close it down?
I've got it open.
Yeah, why don't you give it? I started off last week with the Horizon Report. Why don't you give it a whirl?
Okay. What we're going to be talking about now, during this show, is the Maker Movement. And this is kind of based on an Atlantic article called The Dilemmas of Maker Culture, which is kind of it's kind of a hilarious read. The reason I'm interested in this is I've been thinking about maker spaces in education for quite a while. At the university level, we have a maker space at App State, and it's woefully underutilized. And it's well kitted out. It's got it's not just the normal stuff. It's got like game design stuff, and it's got VR and AR stuff, and it's got high end 3D printers. It's got good equipment in there, but it's kind of tucked away in an awkward place in our library. And I took a group of my students there a couple of semesters ago on a tour of some of the services that App State offers. And you would have thought the woman who was giving the tour, you would have thought nobody else had been there, because she was super excited to show what was capable in this makerspace. And it got me thinking about kind of the resources that we put into these things. And App State did not spare expense. They bought good equipment, and it seems to be a gimmick thing. And I'd be interested in hearing what you think about it from the K-12 level, because I get the sense that maker spaces, for all their potential benefit, are woefully underperforming.
It sounds like you guys have a makerspace that's contained within an unmaker space.
Yeah.
I would agree to some regard. I am not 100% up to speed with the makerspaces that we have in our community here, but my experience has been that, you know, makerspaces tend to be like our old computer labs before we had computers in the classrooms, in carts that teachers can access every day. So you might have a computer room, let's just say like an old computer lab, where teachers can schedule some time, they can bring their classes in there, and I think you inevitably run into the problem of scheduling. Or, you know, a lot of times what we see in K-12 is, you know, we're still confined by having students go through a very traditional curriculum of math, English, social studies, and science, hopefully science, maybe on Mondays and Tuesdays, you get a little science. But the idea is that finding opportunities to embed a very innovative kind of abstract world of creation, you know, in the article, it talked about the potential of constantly creating and recreating, and embedding that type of innovation in a system that is still largely structured around the core subjects. I think it's very difficult for teachers both to plan for it and to schedule opportunities to actually go out there and use it. I think we often see them tucked away. You know, for me, it's just like the old computer labs, as I've already said, but, you know, like having teachers schedule time for the computer labs was always, it's tricky, right? You know, everybody's trying to get in at the same time. And ultimately what happens is the hassle of scheduling means you're not going in. But in K-12, we've seen an incredible uptick in the use of computers when teachers have them in their classrooms. It's probably one of the most exciting things that I've seen here in Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools. We have a hospital school that's associated with the UNC Medical Center here. And it's one of our schools that, you know, but it services students that are going to the hospital for all number of problems and for all number of challenges. And they're working to heal and they're missing class. So the makerspace that we have here is on wheels. So for a lot of times, kids can't come out of the room and they might have a particular issue that they're dealing with. And they, you know, they got to keep their rooms more sterile or whatnot, whatever the case may be. I'm not a doctor. I'm a chief. So. Yeah, look at that. I got a laugh from the background. That's excellent.
That's right.
But the idea is they take this makerspace and they wheel it into the young person's room. And the biggest thing that I've seen is they actually have index lesson plans and learning objectives that can be used for the makerspace rather than, you know, teachers having to come in and schedule the time and come up with the project. They actually have a number of pre-designed cards for different learning objectives and what you can do on the cart. It reminded me of the good old days at Lake Taylor High School back during intern teaching days when we were coming up with the idea of key concepts where every teacher in the building would design a lesson plan that anybody could deliver. So it was an opportunity for substitute teachers to grab a lesson, to get the learning objective, and to have a productive discussion in class. So that struck me as kind of interesting.
See, I like it because at the university level, at least in what I've kind of viewed, it has a very if you build it, they will come kind of feel to it, and nobody comes. You know, they build these things, and it's not really tied to any particular curricula. And yeah. So it reminds me, and this is an argument or a conversation that we've had for a long time about this idea that you can just kind of plop technology in to place and it will magically make stuff happen. Like it will magically, you know, that's the magic dust you sprinkle on a classroom to make things work. And of course, you and I both know that that's not the way it works out. And I don't think I'm breaking any ground here by saying that I'm really reticent to get onto the makerspace bandwagon until we have a better sense of what we want to accomplish with this stuff. And you need buy-in from people to do that. And maybe that's it sounds like the K-12 level is tackling that, at least in Chapel Hill Carborough, in a more direct way. They're trying to make it useful rather than just a buzzword, a sales thing that we can talk about. If we're making tours of the library, you can say, oh, there's our makerspace. And that's empty and dusty and nothing's going on with it.
Yeah, the worst thing you want to see, right, is an impeccably maintained makerspace.
Yeah. I think it should be messy.
It should be messy by definition. I think in the article, it really got to that point exactly, though. And this is one of the things as the chief, one of the things that when I go into a classroom or work with teachers or, you know, working with a colleague in the administrative offices, you know, to continue to ask, what are we trying to accomplish in the classroom? What is our learning objectives? And it spoke in the article to the type of education that people are going to need to thrive in this rapidly changing world that we have now, where people can create and recreate, kind of similar, maybe an extension from the whole gaming movement, you know, and the idea that, you know, in games, kids can always restart. You know, in education in the past, we've been very much, you learn this content, you get a grade on it, you get a C or a D, and there's no ability to restart. You have to go on to the next content area. So, I mean, it really talked about what type of education do people need? And one of the things that they mentioned was the idea of collaboration, right? And I think they also give a hat tip to the millennials, but, you know, it talks about the millennials in a very positive way and then thinking about the future. And, you know, because it talks about the dilemmas that this, you know, 3D printing can have on printing organs or printing art that you can just have in your house and not pay the artist. These kind of moral dilemma issues. But I think one thing that if I could give a hat tip to my brethren, the millennials, is to say, you know, the idea of collaboration, I think, is a lot different today with what we have in social media. I know, I don't actually know if my 15-year-old is a millennial. She might be the next group of the next generation, the unnamed generation maybe. But, you know, when she asks me for help on homework, I give her a couple. It's like How to Be a Millionaire. You know, have you looked on Khan Academy? And have you phoned a friend? You use that device for everything else, but have you reached out to a friend and asked for help? And, you know, one of the things that she says, well, is that cheating or can I do that? And my question is, what are you trying to accomplish? You know, and this is the type of learning that I think we need more in education, is this idea of allowing kids to create and recreate and build off of what they do and learn again. And it's one of the promises that I think is in the maker movement and that I've definitely seen with kids in the classrooms.
See, what's interesting to me about that, the anecdote you just gave about your daughter, is that the answer to whether it's cheating or not depends on what she hopes to accomplish with the activity itself. If the goal is just to get a quote-unquote correct answer, and you get that from phone a friend, then it's kind of cheating. But if it's to understand the concept, and you get that from the phone a friend, then that's not cheating, because it's more deep learning. It's more about contextualizing it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you know, that could, but that's exactly, I think that's a very critical point. You know, this idea of, one of the things the article also mentioned was this idea of, are we teaching people how to think?
Yeah.
And you mentioned it last week when we talked about coding, this idea of thinking in a systematic way. I think in K-12, and this is not about Chapel Hill Carborough in particular, just my overall experience is that, you know, we're still very focused on subject matter rather than the process of how do students think and how do they process information and can they create a product to demonstrate it?
See, that brings in some really interesting questions about the nature of, can a maker movement work in an accountability-driven environment? Because if the goal of a maker movement is to experiment and play and develop and innovate and become an entrepreneur and those kinds of things, those are soft skills that are not valued in a high stakes standardized testing environment.
And you definitely might not be able to measure them at the end of one academic year.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah, which means, can we see the reason I was kind of turned off by this article, and maybe you've got a different perspective on this, but it seemed to be coming more from, and just to, as background, this was basically a review of some of the discussions that happened at a conference in Boulder, Colorado, that was called the Conference on World Affairs, and there were a couple of panel discussions, and it seemed like the approach was more from the Silicon Valley, the rapid prototyping kind of approach, like the business-oriented aspect of the maker spaces, where what is it that it's like? It's very innovative. It's very entrepreneurial, and all of that works really well in a setting like Silicon Valley that is designed to foster that skill set. And so people, it becomes the water that those people swim in. You know what I mean? And so it's just a natural thing to expect. We want, like one of the guys in here talks about, we need to get kids coding much earlier. And, or we need to give iPads and screens to kids at 6 months old just to acclimate them and all these things. And I'm trying to fit that into, I'm trying to fit that square peg into the round hole that is even something as free-flowing as the university level. Like, university doesn't have as many constraints as the K-12 level, but that kind of free-flowing, innovative, you know, entrepreneurial approach doesn't really match up with some of the content-driven, and quite honestly, some of the students are strategic in their approaches to education. They want to learn what's going to get them the best job. And so,
I would think,
telling a kid that they need to get in there and code starting earlier, I'm trying to figure out how to fit that into our particular environments.
I'm just thinking that I would disagree slightly in that for me, I remember, you know, I've never been a professor full time, but in my adjunct world, I think some of the things that I've seen are just as constrained at the university level in that students are preoccupied with getting an A.
True.
I mean, I can imagine, in the worst case was my doctoral students that I taught, and the concept of I need an A, and I would always come back to them and say, but you don't have a GPA. So why don't we learn the material? But you're right on. My wife was going through DuPont Circle one time in D.C., and she called me and she said, I think I just walked through the biggest adult makerspace that I've ever seen before. And what was the focus? The focus was on people turning out a product that they might not necessarily have tools at home to work on. Mm-hmm. So isn't that what we're supposed to be doing in K-12 in our university settings, is preparing students for the jobs of the future? That's the most interesting thing is this idea of we know that we still primarily have an environment, and we're chipping away at it slowly, of a very dated structure, preparing students for industrial jobs, you know, clocking in at 7 o'clock, clocking out at 4, yeah, you know, waiting in line. And we know, I mean, we've been talking about this for 21st century learning, that we're not necessarily preparing students for the jobs of tomorrow, but we're just unable, for any number of reasons, some of which we spoke about last week, and that our society really kind of understands the idea of going to English class and going to biology class. And if I have students that are going to makerspaces all day and working on developing the next hovercraft for them to sell when they graduate, I think our challenge as educators is how then do we ensure that students thrive in an accountability environment? And it gets to the school, right? I mean, this is maybe a topic, but it gets to the XQ Super School Project, that school that you and I were, you know, sitting down and thinking about. And, you know, our focus wasn't on kids having content by the end of the year. You know, the focus of our curriculum is that students might get some different algebra objectives, they might do some English objectives, they might do some biology objectives. But the idea was that over the course of 4 years, they would have everything that they needed. They just might not get that in one calendar year or one semester of biology and check the box and move on. And that, to me, is just our greatest challenge right now, is how do we shift out of this old system into a new system where our focus is on collaboration and critical thinking, and we can go through the four C's if we wanted to, right? I mean, these things that we know we have to obtain, and we're just hesitant, or for, again, the deck is stacked against the system in a lot of ways, but of getting there.
Yeah. The thing that's interesting about that XQ school was that it gets to the bigger issue, which is we're doing people a disservice by compartmentalizing knowledge and thinking that you learn math separate from everything else, and you learn English separate from everything else. And the biggest thing that was really exciting about that school concept to me was that we were doing away with all of that and thinking about it. This also leads back to our discussion last week about the wicked problems and difficult problems and all that, which is, if you give kids a problem and set them on the path, then you just have to support them with whatever knowledge is most important at a particular time, and they'll master it. That's what was exciting to me about that. And that's where you get into that. Yes, they may not sit in a math classroom for 50 minutes a day, but they're learning math because it's meaningful for a larger purpose. That's what would be exciting to me. And I think the maker movement can serve some purpose towards that. I think it can, but in order for it to really meet its potential, I think it has to become more of a central thing in the educational setting rather than just, you know, something tucked into the basement of a library.
Into an unmaker space. That's right.
Exactly.
I think we know it talked about the entrepreneurial ecosystem, that ecosystem of go, go, go.
Yeah.
I think that is one of our biggest challenges in really realizing the potential of a makerspace is the culture of education. Mm-hmm. And culture, as we know, will trump strategy every time, because we can go to any number of conferences and we can go to any number of panelists, and everybody there knows we need to do something different. But realizing that and changing the culture of our education systems, both, and I'm talking about on scale, I'm not talking about here and there and on the success mm-hmm. stories that you read yeah. about, but changing that culture is, I think it can only be done with continuing to expand the makerspace movement. And that's why I applaud people who are working and using the spaces that they have to realize the potential of these, because ultimately that's what got computers into classroom. You know, teachers were able to go in there, begin to realize the potential, and then they would come back and say, hey, we need more of those devices. So maybe the makerspace movement is some of the same thing. We have these rooms that are set up. We're working to get teachers in there. And, you know, just like in the Horizon report, over the next 2, 3, 4 years, there's such a demand for these that maybe we begin to walk in classrooms and having maker spaces in the back of the room where we used to have 3 computers is more of the norm rather than the exception.
Yeah. Well, I think it also is that we not only have to provide the context for it, but there's a sales job here as well, because this also gets back to something that we talked about last week about how difficult it is to convince parents of the merits of an educational initiative that is vastly different from what they went through. And, you know, we all have our opinions about what education should look like because we've all gone through education. And sometimes the parents are the ones fighting against these kinds of things because they don't see the benefit to it because it's not what they went through.
Well, even us, you know, my daughter's in 10th grade now. My oldest is in 10th grade. I need to make sure she's got the credits in the right classes that are going to make her, you know, get into a college that she wants to go to. I'm a part of the problem because I'm in a system that demands it. So it's a real challenge. But, you know, I think these type of makerspace movements augment, it's our virtual reality sandbox. I mean, it's the same thing I think you see with those type of environments when you create a virtual reality sandbox and it gets tucked away and locked up in a room in the back of the hall,
yeah,
in the back of the building, rather than just out in front of the main place where parents are coming in and sand thrown all over the floor.
Yeah.
We're just not there yet.
Well, you know, it's a process. I mean, we'll never get there fully. But we should at least be working towards that.
That's right. That's what we're doing.
All right. Well, we've been at it for almost 30 minutes. So I think at this point, what we should do is we should move to our kind of concluding segment where we actually talk about mud runs and stuff. We need to come up with a catchy title for this segment. I don't know. Mud Run Minute. Is that it?
The Mud Run.
Mudder Minute. Is that it? I don't know. We'll workshop it.
We'll spitball it.
I've got to buy a whiteboard for my house so that I can just put this stuff up. Let me go back to what I was talking about with the new obstacles. Every year at this time, Tough Mudder releases its new obstacles, and one of them is what was it called? Was it called Colossus? It wasn't called Colossus. What was it called?
Which one? Kong Infinity? I don't know.
The new replacement. It's the finish. Happy Endings. That's what it was called.
Happy Ending, yeah.
Did you see that one?
I did. Of course, I've watched all the videos.
Yeah.
Who's not going to watch a video called Happy Ending?
Yeah. Did they have Kong Infinity at World's Toughest?
Yeah.
How'd you do on it?
Nailed it.
Did you?
Nailed it twice.
Rings and all.
Rings and all. Did it twice.
Maybe it's the swinging rings that you have problems with.
You know, it's just these were the rings that they had the rings there as well. And the rings were steel. They were pretty thick, and they were extremely wet. Mm-hmm. These were smaller and rubberized, so you didn't slip.
Oh, good.
So it was nice to feel that I had the experience to do it and had the strength to do it. Yeah, but those steel rings—they're just—they're wet. I'm just worthless on them.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was good, man. I'm telling you, I was one of those obstacles where I completed it, and I just explode with a huge yell on the top of it. I mean, it was great.
Well, the post I put up on our blog was about the other one, was about the happy endings, and happy endings is being sold as like this. It's just bigger and better. It's a bigger ramp that you have to get up. And then there's a slide on the other side that slides into a water pit and all this other stuff. And it's not very inventive because it's just like Colossus at Savage Race, which has been doing that same thing. But what they added was they added an electrical component on the back. If you wanted to go down, you could go through, like you could slide through basically a, electroshock therapy, which is electrified wires hanging down that shock you.
We just lost all our subscribers.
Yeah. People are thinking, what kind of craziness is this? And the funniest thing that I saw was that on the Facebook group that was discussing this, they were mentioning the idea, like, what could possibly go wrong with sliding down through these wires? And they were showing that GIF of that guy who was running and got his neck hooked on a wire and got flipped up. And that's bad enough when you're running through the thing, but imagine if you're sliding and your momentum's keeping you going. And so I put that GIF up on that post just to present it. And I felt the need, because the guy kind of looks like me. And so I said, no gazelles were harmed in the making of the GIF. but the bigger issue, and to bring it back to the education, I mean, the purpose of that blog is not only to talk about mud runs and stuff, but also to talk about the lessons that we've learned in terms of educational leadership and those kinds of things. And what I was disappointed about with the discussion around happy endings, aside from just the unfortunate name of it, was that it seemed to be built as an obstacle that you needed to do as a group, which just, I get frustrated whenever there's something that requires group work. I don't mind doing group work. I don't mind helping people up. I don't mind being helped up, but I don't want to sit there and wait for people to come up behind me. Or I don't want to be there with a bunch of people I don't know, feeling like I have to be the bottom person on the pyramid to let a bunch of people climb up me. I'm not interested in that. So I'm interested in seeing how it looks in practice, whether it's possible to conquer that thing individually or whether you have to do it in, as a group.
I mean, it looked like they had 6 or 7 people stacked up on each other. I don't know how you're going to get up that one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's not that much different than... what's the other one called? Pyramid scheme, which if you get there early enough and there's not enough people, they have ropes down it. And it's pretty easy to climb up pyramid scheme with the ropes. But
Your leadership lesson is basically, damn it, I don't want to wait on anybody.
No, I'll tell you what the post was about. The leadership lesson that I took from that was, I think that, whereas I'm perfectly happy to help people, part of my enjoyment of this is challenging myself and feeling as if I have no shot at completing an obstacle by myself is a little bit disappointing to me. I want to feel like I can at least give it a shot. Every other obstacle on a Tough Mudder course, you can legitimately do by yourself if you have the skill set. But if you can't, like, there's no way to run up that thing. You can't even get a running start because you have to start from a puddle of water. So you can't even get a running start. So I was the leadership lesson I was taking from that was, it's incumbent upon the developers to understand the psychology of the people who go through Tough Mudders, mm-hmm. to understand that they have that psychology in them. The people who do these things have that psychology and they want to challenge themselves. They want to feel as if they can do it by themselves. Even if they do end up needing help, that's fine. I have yet to get up Everest 2.0 all by myself, but I get up it. That doesn't stop me from at least trying it. That's the big takeaway. I'm not averse to help, but I think the help can come in a lot of different ways, not just a hand up or a line of people you climb up. It can come from the developers of these things understanding the psychology of the people who are taking part.
I myself have just been nostalgic about the return of the old. I like having the old obstacles that we used to have so much fun on back in the early days.
Have they announced which ones are coming back, or is it still up to vote?
It's still up to vote.
It's Electric Eel.
Great.
Mandatory. World's toughest. Mandatory obstacle. And it's a mile long.
I won't do it. When you've been electrocuted as many times as we've been electrocuted,
yeah.
I don't need to challenge myself anymore.
Yeah. All right. Well, with that, it's, you know, we're well over 30 minutes. So, Daniel, I am going to wrap up the discussion, say thank you very much. As always, we've solved all of the world's problems. This is what we do when we're running. We just conquer the world's problems in between bouts of Danny singing, which, yeah,
is what it is. There's moments in themselves, right?
Yeah, it's what keeps us going. That's why I'm always so far ahead. I try to get away from earshot.
Maybe that could be one of our segments. I could end with a song.
Please do not. Please do not. We can't afford the copyright.
This is true. I have no original songs, of course.
That's right. All right, Danny. I'll talk to you next week.
Always a pleasure.
All right. Bye.